From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, film director Sidney Pollack. He made Out of Africa, Tootsie, The Way We Were, and the new film Havana, starring Robert Redford. Also, we talked to accordion player C.J. Chenier about following in the footsteps of his father, Clifton Chenier, the king of Zydeco. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward gives us his holiday picks for this year's Best Rock and Roll CD Reissues. And book critic John Leonard reviews John Edgar Wideman's new novel, Philadelphia Fire, loosely based on the 1985 bombing of the cult group MOVE. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze said today that he'll meet tomorrow with Angolan rebel leader Jonas Savimbi. Savimbi's UNITA rebels have been fighting Angola's Soviet-backed government for more than 15 years. It would be the first meeting between Shevardnadze and Savimbi. At the same time, the State Department announced that Secretary of State James Baker will meet with Angola's foreign minister. The United States and the Soviet Union have been supporting rival sides in the Angolan civil war. Tomorrow's meetings are aimed at preparing for formal negotiations next month in Lisbon. Hundreds of hostages were flown out of Iraq today, and remaining hostages could be out by the end of the week. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
In just 3 days, more than 1,600 foreigners have left Iraq. Last week, Saddam Hussein lifted travel restrictions for all foreigners. Chartered planes from Baghdad arrived today in London, Bangkok, and Frankfurt. Another plane is en route to London. Most of the passengers were used as human shields at strategic installations in Iraq, or they avoided arrest by hiding in Kuwait after the August invasion. U.S. authorities hope remaining hostages can leave Baghdad by Thursday. About 500 U.S. citizens are voluntarily staying in Iraq or Kuwait for family reasons, according to U.S. State Department officials. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
The Algerian president flew to Jordan today en route to Baghdad. Algeria is trying to negotiate a peaceful settlement to the Gulf crisis. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
President Tebboune Benjedid of Algeria is the only Arab leader since the Gulf crisis began in August to visit both Baghdad and Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. It's a significant move, say his Jordanian host, because it marks more momentum for a peaceful initiative in the Gulf. But the outcome of Benjedid's mission, which will also take him to Syria and Oman, probably depends on the intransigence of both Iraq and Saudi Arabia. It's unlikely that Benjedid, a tough Arab negotiator, would be visiting both countries if he didn't think there was something to discuss. He'll try to see that the two countries at least get to the bargaining table. He almost certainly wants to tell Baghdad that it must withdraw from Kuwait, but he also warned the Saudis that foreign forces represent an even greater threat in the Gulf. Benjedid flies to Baghdad tomorrow. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
Lithuanian President Vytautas Landsbergis said today that Soviet officials have threatened a new blockade against the breakaway Baltic republics. Landsbergis said the threat came from Gosplan, the Soviet Central Planning Organization. He said that Gosplan had informed Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia that the embargo will begin on January 1st unless they agree to return to the Central Planning System. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 11 points to close at 2,586.14. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sidney Pollack, used to be an actor, but in the last 25 years as a director, he's worked with some of the best-known actors in Hollywood. He directed Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie, Jane Fonda in They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, Paul Newman in Absence of Malice, Robert Mitchum in The Yakuza, Robert Redford and Barbara Streisand in The Way We Were, and Meryl Streep and Redford in Out of Africa. Pollack's new film, Havana, is the seventh movie that he's made with Robert Redford. It's set in Cuba just before the revolution. Redford plays a card shark who runs games in Havana casinos. He has no interest in causes or politics until he falls in love with a revolutionary played by Lena Olin. Pollack initially planned to shoot the film in Cuba.
I was a bit naive about it because of the political situation that exists between our two countries. Cuba is officially considered an enemy country at the moment, and there is a Treasury Department law which is called Trading with the Enemy, which I would have violated had we gone to Havana and spent, you know, American hard currency there, which I would have had to do. So I was sort of charging forward naively, thinking I was going to have to talk the Cuban government into letting me go down there. And in fact, it was the American government that stopped the filming. So I had to sort of duplicate everything in Santo Domingo.
You know, even if you'd gone to Cuba, though, you probably would have had to do a lot of constructing, because I'm sure a lot has changed since the revolution.
Well, oddly enough, when you go there, it's as though time stood still. It's in disrepair, but nothing much has changed. I mean, the cars are still pre-58 cars, mostly American. There are some Russian cars there now, but a lot of the old American cars are still there. The buildings and architecture is the same. The fountains are dry, but they're still there, and you can sort of imagine, if you got the water running in the fountains and touched up the paint, you can walk along the Malecón, which is this waterfront area that they have there, and you can almost hear music from the casinos in your head. It's very much the same.
Robert Redford is the star of Havana, and you know, in the first part of the movie, he's just this you know, card-playing womanizer, and he undergoes quite a change by the end. But I'm wondering if you think that, you know, with Robert Redford in a role like this, if the audience doesn't kind of figure in advance, he's got to reform in some way, because after all, it's Robert Redford, and when he makes a movie, he has to kind of believe in the message of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's normally playing a guy who has somewhat heroic dimensions. I think that's what we've sort of slotted him into that category, and we do expect it from him. In his early days, he played some creepy guys like Little Foss and Big Halsey and those things, but I think the general way in which we've come to accept him is someone who is as someone who's something of a hero. I sort of accept him that way, and also that particular character is a character I'm personally more in sympathy with than let's say somebody else. But I think what Bob does in the picture is extraordinary. I mean, I think it's a more vulnerable, farther reach than we've seen him do in a while. He plays a character quite a bit different from himself, much lower life, a little sleazier, a guy with a little less intelligence than he himself has, a guy with less education. He's certainly not a graduate student. He's certainly not an aristocrat, which is what we usually expect, I think, from Redford, and usually what he plays.
You know what I think is frustrating for a lot of both actresses and women who watch movies is that, you know, we see as actors age, they still get to play the hero. And as they age, they keep playing up against women who are the same age that the men were when they started their careers. You know, you have like Paul Newman and Robert Redford who are, you know, in their 50s. And they often, you know, play up against women in their 20s or early 30s.
Yeah.
And, you know, like women don't age in movies, but men do, and yeah, that's fine.
It ain't fair.
Yeah.
You're right. You're quite right. And but that's a sort of a part of our society structure. I mean, it's we don't think much of it when we see a 55-year-old man with a 30-year-old woman in a restaurant, but we probably would be a little bit more, I would say shocked, but we'd react more strongly if it were reversed. It's strange. I don't know why that is, but it is.
How did you end up making so many movies with Robert Redford?
Just unlucky, really. I don't know. He and I, we've been friends for about 30 years. Really. Uh-huh. We met in 1960 on a film we acted together in called War Hunt. It was before I was directing. And we hit it off as friends, and then about 5 years later, after I'd started directing television, we did a first film together, which was a film called This Property is Condemned with Natalie Wood. And it was a good working relationship. I think, you know, we couldn't be more disparate in most qualities. We're absolutely completely opposite as people. But in the areas that are really important when you work together, such as a judgment about a scene or a taste or something like that, we're pretty much in agreement. We have a good working relationship.
Director Sidney Pollack is my guest. His new movie is Havana, and he also directed Tootsie Out of Africa, Absence of Malice, The Way We Were, and They Shoot Horses, among other films. A lot of our listeners will know the way you look from your role in Tootsie. You not only directed the movie, but you played the role of Dustin Hoffman's agent. And I want to play a clip from a scene here in which Dustin Hoffman kind of storms into your office And he, of course, plays this kind of difficult, self-absorbed actor. This is a scene before he takes the part of a woman's role in a soap opera. And he's in your office demanding to know why you can't get him a decent part, why he's always out of work.
You've got one of the worst reputations in this town, Michael. Nobody will hire you.
Are you saying that nobody in New York will work with me?
Oh, no, that's too limited. Nobody in Hollywood wants to work with you either. I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They want a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic! A tomato can't move!
That's what I said. So if he can't move, how's he going to sit down, George? I was a stand-up tomato, a juicy, sexy beefsteak tomato. Nobody does vegetables like me. I did an evening of vegetables off Broadway. I did the best tomato, the best cucumber. I did an endive salad that knocked the critics on their ass.
One of the funny things about that scene is that it almost seems to be a joke about how obsessive Dustin Hoffman is as an actor, and I've always wondered if that scene reflects at all what the real working relationship was like.
Well, there was an awful lot written about the amount of arguing that Dustin and I were doing publicly. A lot of it true and a lot of it exaggerated. There's an element that Dustin is famous for of his, of his fastidiousness that can sometimes drive people crazy. And it's true that we argued and fought, not oddly enough about the acting. We fought mostly about script. We had slightly differing points of view about the tone of that, about what the tone of that picture ought to be. And so we argued. But usually we got our arguments over with fairly early in the morning, and by the time we got out on the set and started really working as director and actor within the context of a scene, we rarely argued after that.
It seems to me you were probably the kind of director who'd be more understanding of a very obsessive actor, having taught actors and having been the executive director of the West Coast branch of the Actors Studio. I mean, these you've worked with a lot of method actors.
Well, I started out as a teacher, actually. So the only thing I had as a tool when I began to direct was some understanding of the psychology of actors, let's say, or a language, a vocabulary to talk with them. I had no sense of how to talk to a writer, and I didn't know which end of a camera to look through because my background had all been theater. But I was comfortable with actors and always have been, really.
How come you haven't acted more? I mean, at what point you started off acting? At what point in your career did you think that, although you loved theater, that acting wasn't for you?
Somebody recommended to me, actually, a director named John Frankenheimer and then Burt Lancaster, the actor. I'd worked together with them on a movie as a coach. I was a dialogue coach for a couple of young actors on a movie in 1960 called The Young Savages. And they both encouraged me very strongly to direct, and that was a new idea to me. It was not something I never had any strong goals to be a director, and they pushed very hard, and so I thought, well, what the hell, I'll try it. And so I moved to California, and I started doing it. Once I began to do that, I had no thoughts about acting at all. Dustin really pushed me into doing that. I never would have played that part. That was another source of irritation, is he started insisting that I play this part. Dustin believes that there's enough to make up on a set, that any time you can get close to the truth, you should do it. And what he kept saying was, I don't know why I put the dress on. In Some Like It Hot, the guys put the dress on because of machine guns. They're gonna die if they don't disguise themselves. We got to really get me a reason. I kept saying, well, when your agent says to you, you're never going to work again, and he says, well, I would put it on if you said it to me, but I wouldn't put it on if a peer said it to me, because I had a very good actor all set to play that part. And he kept saying, I want you to play that part. And I kept saying, Dustin, you're crazy. I got enough to do. I haven't acted in years, and I don't want to do it. And finally, he started sending me flowers, dozens of roses, saying, please be my agent. Love, Dorothy. And I really ended up doing it basically to mollify him.
Well, the him wanting to know, like, why is he putting on a dress reminds me of him in the scene wanting to know, like, how can a tomato sit down?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Were there other explanations you had to give him in the movie?
Not so much explanations, but...
Motivations.
But yeah, motivations. Well, no, it's very hard to do what an actor does, and it's very subjectively driven, and it's very, very hard for a very good actor, and Dustin is a very good actor. It's very, very hard for them sometimes to see in third person, which is really the director's job, of how this is going to work. Because to do the part well, you begin to see the world from inside of the role. And sometimes you can get confused or you misunderstand intentions which are coming from the outside in, which is, you know, the director trying to have some sort of overview of it. So occasionally, sure, there are always, I wouldn't say fights, but discussions about how can I do this or how can I do that when this happened? And then you have to carefully explain it, not so much with intellectual logic, but with some sort of behavioral logic.
You were explaining that your transition into directing was working as a dialogue coach for a movie Frankenheimer directed, The Young Savages.
Mm-hmm.
And that starred Burt Lancaster and Shelley Winters.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do as dialogue coach, and did you work directly with Lancaster and Winters?
No, what I did, well, my job originally was to, there were three young men in that picture who were very inexperienced. They were kind of novice, new actors. They were playing juvenile delinquents, and my job basically was to kind of coach them in their acting and work with them on the roles. I had done that once before in a television show called The Turn of the Screw, a Playhouse 90 that John Frankenheimer had directed, and he had used me in that capacity, and I was able to do it without getting in his way. It's a tough job to do, to try to kind of direct actors and not get in the way of the director. But in this case, my job was to help these novice actors act, and Lancaster got curious as to what I was doing, and he used to say, "Hey, kid, come over here. What are you telling those kids?" You know, and he started kidding around with me, and I began to talk to him about what I was talking to them about, and then he would occasionally talk to me about a scene himself, and we started to talk it over. And when the picture was all done, and I was supposed to come back to New York, I got a message from his secretary. He had a big office at Columbia. Said Mr. Lancaster wants to talk to you, and I went over there, and he sat behind his desk, and he said, "You know, you ought to be a director. You really should. What do you want to be told what to do when you can be telling everybody what to do for?" That was the way he put it. And he picked up the phone and he called Lou Wasserman and said, "Lou, I got a kid here. I don't know if he can direct, but I think he's talented. I want you to talk to him." And I'm quoting verbatim now, and he said, "In any case, he can't be worse than those bums you got working for you now." And he said, so I had to go see Lou Wasserman feeling like an absolute dope, because Lou was clearly doing Bert a favor. He couldn't have cared less about me, and I must say he was a wonderful man. I went to see him in the office there, and he said, "Bert says you should be a director." And I said, "Well, I guess." He says, "Well, have you ever directed anything?" I said, "Nope." And, you know, I just sort of sat there like a dope. And he said, "Look, here's what I'll do. You come to California, and I'll let you come and observe for 6 months out at Universal Studios. I'll put you under the wing of a producer. And we'll go a step at a time. If they think you're talented, we'll see if we can get you a television show to do." And that's, in fact, what I did.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is director Sidney Pollack, and his new movie, Havana, stars Robert Redford and Lena Olin. And he also directed Tootsie, Out of Africa, Absence of Malice, The Way We Were, They Shoot Horses, Don't They, and many other films. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Director Sidney Pollack is my guest. His new movie is called Havana. There's something very New York about you. I mean, in Tootsie, you're the New York agent. You said that Burt Lancaster thought of you as the New York acting coach. You're from Indiana. How did you get to be so New York?
I guess that was the age that I was when I got here. I was 17. I'd just gotten out of high school. And I spent those years, those 6 years, 7 years, between the time I was 17 and 24, and I guess they're sort of formative years. And I took to New York like a guy who'd, you know, been missing it all his life. I don't know. I just felt at home here from the first day I got off a train and settled in at a YMCA and sort of, you know, went to school and began making friends. It still feels like home in many ways to me.
Do you have any cameos in movies from your acting days that we could look for you in?
I mean,
small parts. I shouldn't say cameos. You weren't a star doing a little Star Trek in there.
I'm in a lot of my movies, but not in anything recognizable. I'm in 3 Days of the Condor and I'm in Electric Horseman.
Uh-huh.
But usually that'll happen because sometimes the hardest thing to do is if you have one line. You have a character, let's say, that's got one line, and it's with one of the stars, and it's during movement, let's say. The scene is a dollying shot or a tracking shot or something that's difficult technically, and you need somebody to hit a mark and say one line. Well, it's really gets tough sometimes because the actors that are playing parts that small, it's really unfair to them to rush them in and have them do it quickly. They're nervous. They're much more nervous than somebody who's got a bigger role to play and can get accustomed to the star. They're nervous in front of the star. They're nervous in front of the director. And sometimes you just lose an enormous amount of time. And rather than go through it all, I stick a mustache on sometimes and throw a, you know, and comb my hair funny and just jump in and do it. Not because I like acting, but just in the interest of efficiency.
Most of your movies, including your new movie, Havana, were shot in Panavision. What is Panavision exactly?
Well, Panavision is a brand name. We think of it as synonymous with widescreen. Mm-hmm. Actually, it isn't. Widescreen, the real name is scope. It's a ratio of the height of the screen to the width of the screen. And the Panavision or scope ratio is very wide. It's 2.33. To one. The length from left to right is 2 1/3 times as long as the height is high. In other words, it'd be 2.33 inches wide to 1 inch high in that ratio. And it has a very different feeling than the standard film ratio, which is 1.85 to 1, which is what Havana is shot in. I love the widescreen, not for any other reason than you can get more information per second on the screen. When I did a film like They Shoot Horses, Don't They, which was all interiors. Everybody argued with me about why in God's name I would want a widescreen process inside on a dance floor. And the answer was because I could see all of the other couples and still be in close-up on Jane Fonda and Michael Sarrazin, or that I would always have a sense of the background or a sense of environment. So I always loved this widescreen process. The problem is, as more and more revenue began to come in from ancillary markets like television and cassettes,
mm-hmm.
It's a horrifying experience to see a scope picture on television. You see two noses, one on each side of the screen, talking to each other, you know, and you don't even know who the person is. And so they have a process called panning and scanning, where an engineer has to take a, let's say, a two-shot where two people are looking at each other in profile that you've shot steady. And the television screen can't encompass that area. So an engineer is actually photographing within the boundaries of your frame, and he's panning the camera back and forth to the two people as they talk to each other. So he's, in a sense, redirecting your film. It's a terrible experience. So the last two films, Out of Africa and Havana, I've shot in the standard ratio.
Well, you must think it's pretty unfortunate that the ratio of the television screen is determining how movies are shot.
I think it's terrible. But now, people like Woody Allen, for example, who does use scope often, he has his pictures what they call letterboxed, which is that when they go on television, there's a black border at the top and a black border at the bottom so that the aspect ratio is accurate. But unfortunately, what that does is, while it does preserve the framing, it reduces the size of the image down so much that that's also a problem. So you're always dealing with a compromise when you're worried about these ancillary markets. I don't know that there is an answer to this problem. They're not going to change the ratio of television. But it's too bad because the widescreen does offer a wonderful tool to work with if you're concerned about environments. I mean, I wish I had been able to shoot out of Africa in scope ratio. I think it would have been more beautiful to look at.
Director Sidney Pollack is my guest. His new movie is Havana, and he also shot out of Africa, Tsetse, Absence of Malice, The Way We Were, They Shoot Horses. Your father was a pharmacist and had been a professional boxer, is that right?
Yeah, he was a semi-professional boxer. He was a guy who fought for a living when he was young, when he was getting ready to go to college and then going to college. He was sponsored by a beer then called Hoosier Beer. Get it, Indiana? Hoosier.
Right.
it didn't last for very long, but I remember it when I was a kid. Everybody drank Hoosier beer out there.
Did you go to any of your father's fights?
No. This was...
He stopped before
This was before I was born, yeah.
What were the movies that you really loved growing up that made you want to act?
The movies that I remember very vividly as a young man were movies like A Place in the Sun and Shane, The Best Years of Our Lives. All the Kazan movies, I think, were the ones that made me think a lot about acting. Mm-hmm. By the time I was watching Kazan's movies, I was occasionally in some small plays in school. And watching Viva Zapata and On the Waterfront and East of Eden and, films like that, I was very aware for the first time of that was the first time I was really aware of a director, I think.
Yeah.
And I always identified him with these great performances.
I was reading about you in a current biography, and it described you as being known as a lion tamer because of your success with temperamental big-name stars, because you've worked with Streisand and Streep, Redford, Hoffman, Newman. Do you think you have to be a lion tamer to work with temperamental big-name stars? I mean, do you think of yourself as having to deal with temperament a lot?
Not at all. Really not at all. I mean, I don't find them to be any more temperamental or any more difficult. I don't know why you would refer to them as a lion tamer, but I suppose the conventional picture of a star is someone who's got a big ego and bosses people around and therefore is difficult to work with. That's really not true. To be honest with you, I've found more temperament among the people that aren't the stars than I've found with the stars that I've worked with.
Well, Sidney Pollack, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about movies.
Thank you for the good questions.
Thanks for joining us. And my guest has been director Sidney Pollack. His new movie, Havana, stars Robert Redford and Lena Olin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
¿Qué le pasó a ese pobre jamaiquino, señores? Decía Mister La Handigúa, La Handigúa, ya se rompió, Handigúa se rompió, si se rompe se compone, 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 rompelo.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Musician Clifton Chenier was known as the King of Zydeco. Coming up, we meet his son, C.J. Chenier, who plays the accordion like his father did and took over the Red Hot Louisiana Band after his father died. Also, rock historian Ed Ward picks the year's best reissues. And book critic John Leonard reviews the novel Philadelphia Fire by John Edgar Wideman. It's about the aftermath of the bombing of the Move House in Philadelphia, which was home to an African-American cult group. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Israeli Prime Minister Shamir met with President Bush today and afterwards expressed confidence that the meeting had enhanced the relationship between the United States and Israel. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The two leaders discussed the need to revitalize the Israeli-Palestinian peace process after the Persian Gulf crisis is ended. Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly said ideas for reviving the peace process were explored in general terms, by and large. Mr. Bush expressed concern about Israel's policy of building Jewish settlements in the occupied territories, but Kelly said the two leaders never discussed the Temple Mount incident, in which Israeli police killed 18 Palestinians in Jerusalem 2 months ago. On the Persian Gulf crisis, the Prime Minister came away from today's meeting assured that the U.S. would not accept a deal that would harm Israel's interests.
I trust the President. What he said, he said it several times, and he said it to me now again, that there will not be any deal at the expense of Israel.
The President also assured Mr. Shamir that the U.S. will maintain Israel's military superiority in the region. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
And the Soviet Union's top diplomat will meet tomorrow in Washington with the leader of the Angolan rebel group that has been fighting the Soviet-backed government for over 15 years. Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze says that he will meet with Jonas Savimbi in the first meeting between the two. The Communist Party of Albania has moved quickly to satisfy public opinion following 3 days of noisy street protest. 7 members of the ruling Politburo have been dismissed, and opposition political parties legalized in a major shakeup. Pierre Vickery reports.
The Albanian president, Rami Zelia, has dismissed 7 members of the ruling Politburo in a major political purge. Among those to lose their posts are the hardline interior minister and the elderly Central Committee secretary, Foto Chami. The move follows 3 days of at times violent street protests by workers and students demanding more extensive and faster reforms. The government has also announced that opposition parties will be allowed to contest national elections on February the 10th, and that the president will meet student leaders to discuss their grievances. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
According to a border guard commander in Czechoslovakia, his country has increased controls on the Soviet border by 200% over the last month in advance of an expected large exodus of Soviet immigrants. The commander said that border guards have been transferred from the Czech border with Germany. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down close to 11 points to close at 2,586.14 on volume of some 145 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, Zydeco music with C.J. Chenier, son of the King of Zydeco. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says if the CD revolution has done anything, it's made a lot of music from the past available again, sometimes sounding better than it did the first time around. For instance, now you can get properly remixed and remastered Led Zeppelin.
If this time of year means anything, it's that there are lots of you out there looking for gifts or dropping hints for gifts. So I've decided to kill a few birds with one stone here by highlighting the year's best reissues. Maybe you'll get an idea for a gift, and meanwhile, I can thank the American record companies who are, at long last, systematically making our history available to us again, something the Europeans and Japanese have been doing for years. Now, when I say reissue, I don't mean a re-release. Capitol, for instance, has re-released the Beach Boys and the Band's albums with new and scholarly liner notes and done a great job with them. I'm talking about collections that highlight an artist or a period in a form that's never existed as such before.
Every time I'm walking down the streets, some pretty mama start breaking down with me, start breaking down. Yeah, start breaking down. The stuff I got a bunch of brains out, baby, it'll make you lose your mind.
Probably the most noteworthy reissue of the year is one that's been ready for over a decade while scholars fought over a couple of photographs. Columbia's Robert Johnson collection features every note the great blues mystery man ever recorded, an essential for any blues collection. Their new Roots and Blues series also has superb reissues of Lonnie Johnson, Big Bill Brunzi, and the Big Three Trio, along with collections of slide guitar players, blues with topical lyrics, and a Legends of the Blues anthology that's a great place to start learning about blues. They also did a Cajun collection, although I think the Country Music Foundation's Le Grand Mamou collection has the edge here. Rock and roll's earliest years have gotten a boost from Specialty Records, which recorded some of the prime movers in the late 40s. They've come out with a slew of reissues devoted to Roy Milton, Joe and Jimmy Liggins, Percy Mayfield, Jesse Belvin, and Larry Williams. Great listening, though the notes, which are by an egomaniac named Billy Vera, could have been a lot more informative.
What you say, man? Quit mumbling and talk out loud.
And MCA, which in past years has given us box sets by Chuck Berry and Muddy Waters, this year has given us the Bo Diddley box set, which is as beautifully notated and remastered as you could ask for. Howlin' Wolf next year, you guys. An equally well-done project is Columbia Special Products' Roy Orbison collection, four CDs tracing his career. Unfortunately, what it accidentally demonstrates is that Roy recorded a lot of stuff like this.
There once was an Indian brave by the name of Yellow Hand. He fell in love with a maiden known as White Sand. They vowed the love would last forevermore. Then came the day that they had waited for. Yellow Hand brought her a golden feather. White Sand said a prayer for good weather. The ceremonial dance grew loud and strong. Then Yellow Hand began their wedding song.
For obsessives only, I'm afraid. The Byrds have long deserved a coherent telling of their story, and this year they got it, a four-CD box that looks like a tombstone and has awful graphics inside. But the remastered selections are gorgeous, and if the fourth disc demonstrates the band's slide into mediocrity, well, that's history too. Without a doubt, this has been the year when the 70s started coming back. For one thing, there's Atlantic's four-disc Led Zeppelin set, described by my colleague Brent Grolke as all the Zeppelin you're ever going to need. What you don't need is PolyGram's 20th anniversary edition of the complete Layla sessions by Derek and the Dominoes. True, the original Layla album was horribly mixed, and the remixed disc is wonderful. The disc of outtakes, and especially the one of jams, on the other hand, only underscore what feeble improvisers rock musicians can be. The remixed Layla by itself will be available next year. You don't need to spend $40 on this. I've done this whole thing without mentioning Rhino Records, which is largely a reissue label. They've done some great ones by Wanda Jackson, Del Shannon, two girl group anthologies, and many more. But for that special person on your list, you might like to consider that they've released a 15-volume series of the 70s greatest pop hits, and that's only up to 1975. Pure torture and better than coal in the stocking any day.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Accordion player Clifton Chenier was the unchallenged king of Zydeco. Zydeco is a Louisiana hybrid of blues, French dance music, and rhythm and blues. Chenier was the first to take the music outside Louisiana's Gulf Coast. Clifton Chenier died 3 years ago. Since then, his group, the Red Hot Louisiana Band, has been led by his son, C.J. Chenier, who joined the band 10 years before his father's death. Three members of Clifton Chenier's touring band still remain in the group. From the new album Hot Rod by C.J. Chenier and the Red Hot Louisiana Band, this is I Got My Eyes on You, featuring C.J. Chenier on accordion and vocals. Do you think that you're playing for different audiences now or for different kinds of audiences than your father played for when he was starting out?
Well, when he started out, he was mostly playing house parties back in Louisiana, you know, where they play a nickel, a dime, a quarter to get in and party all night long. But now Zydeco is reaching out and getting a whole lot wider audience. You're getting the younger people and the older people, as well as the people in the mid-ages coming out to check out Zydeco's.
How close do you think your style is to your late father's?
Well, like I always say, I learned everything I know from him, all the songs I know besides the ones I wrote. And it's the only thing is I play accordion like I play saxophone, you know? So it might make my improvising a little different than he does. But basically, I think I must have some of his style because I only heard him. That's the only accordion player I listened to.
Now, you didn't listen to Zydeco when you were growing up. Your father's from Louisiana, and you grew up in Port Arthur, Texas. How old were you when your parents separated?
My parents were never married.
Oh, I see. So your parents were never married. Did you know your father?
Oh, yeah. I saw him all the time. It's just that he didn't live with us, you know.
How close were you before you actually started to play together?
Well, before I started playing with him, we weren't really that close, you know. But we weren't really separate, but we weren't the tight as a father and son, you know.
Did you keep up with his music? Did you listen at all when you were growing up?
No. They had one song that I listened to all the time when I was growing up, and that was Hot Rod. All the rest, I never listened to anything else.
You do Hot Rod on the new record. I think it's a great cut. It has this very Peter Gunn kind of bass line to it.
Yeah, I like that song, and I always did, and that's I think that's why I recorded it again.
Well, why don't we give it a listen?
Okay.
Woo-hoo! Hot Rod!
So you were listening to Hot Rod when you were growing up. Why of your father's whole output was this the song that you used to listen to?
Maybe because of the type of music I used to play, that song appealed to me more than the rest, because it wasn't blues and wasn't waltzy, but like you said, it had that Peter Gunn type, and we liked Peter Gunn when I was growing up.
Oh, sure. So what were your preconceptions of Zydeco music?
Well, I thought it was just for older people, and I didn't really know how hard the Zydeco crowds parted until I started playing Zydeco music.
And you started playing Zydeco music in 1978 when your father invited you to join the band.
Right.
Why did he invite you to join?
The original sax player, John Hart, the greatest Zydeco sax player I ever heard. I think at the time he got sick or something like that, and he couldn't make a tour that they were about to go on, so he called me up.
Now, did the music all sound the same to you when you started?
Very much so. I couldn't tell one song from the next. Just all sounded Japanese to me because, I had been listening to James Brown, Earth, Wind & Fire, and Commodores and stuff like that. And when I played I had been to hear my father before, and the song sounded the same to me then. But it wasn't until I really got on stage and started playing the songs that I could distinguish them.
And when you realized what was different about it, what opened up to you in the music? What did you start to really appreciate about it?
Just so much of a party music, It's like when I was playing disco, we had a good time, we had a good band. But the crowds party a whole lot more in Zydeco than just about any other music that I've ever played. And that makes for a real good time.
You know, we're talking about party music, but on the other hand, you do some tunes that are more like rhythm and blues ballads, like Before It's Too Late.
Yeah, well, Zydeco is not just one type of... The Zydeco, a la-la consists of more than one type of music. You play Zydeco songs, but then you play waltzes, and you play ballads, and you play a little bebop in there, too, also. And you mix it all up, and you get a Zydeco gumbo out of that,
I'm so glad you've been around. You were someone that never let me down. I feel so bad. I never said I love you.
Now, initially, you played alto saxophone. How did you start playing accordion?
Well, I started kind of fiddling around with my dad's accordion every now and then. And then he gave me one, and I took it home, and every blue moon I would pick it up. But then when he got real sick, I kind of had to start opening a show for him. So I learned on stage.
Did he want you to take over the band?
Yeah, he used to always tell me you got to learn how to play the accordion, bye. The old hog ain't going to always be able to do it. You're going to have to take over for me one day. And he would tell me that all the time, but I never thought it would happen.
Your father was known as the King of Zydeco. He actually had a crown, didn't he?
Right.
What was the crown like?
Well, it had these... I've seen it a few times, but it had these rubies and blue things and all that kind of stuff on there. And it was given to him by the Pope in Europe, the Pope or the Bishop, one of the two, in Europe a long time ago, but even before I got interested in the music,
What was the occasion for giving it to him?
I'm not sure. I think they just, he was the first one to bring the music over, and they just crowned him the King of Zydeco.
Could you really relate to that on a James Brown level? He has a scepter,
No, but, it's really not a gimmick, because I heard that statement before that it's just a gimmick, and it's not that. And it was real to him, And he didn't have a scepter. All he had was this crown. He didn't wear capes and all kind of fur and all of that junk or none of that. All he had was the crown that was given to him.
Where is the crown now?
His wife has it, mm-hmm. Margaret Chenier.
On the liner notes to your new record. You thank a lot of people, and you thank the Red Hot Louisiana Band, your band, for going through the hard times with you. What hard times are you referring to?
Well, you know, it's like when you first start off, things aren't easy at all, you know. It's because, like, when we're at home, when we first started, when we were at home, we didn't work hard at all. You know, it's like the only time we worked was on the road. And they might not be hard times to other people, but to me, it was hard times. Just them sticking with a new face into the Zydeco music. And because a lot of times I know the guys get discouraged, but they hang in there.
So that's changed now? You play Louisiana more often?
A little bit more, yeah.
What's responsible for the change?
Well, people have to get adjusted to the change, you know. And at first, it was like people thought I was riding on my father's name, you know, just because he is Chenier and this and that and the other. But it's like you have to prove yourself. Like, hey, I might be a Chenier, but can I play? That's up to you to decide. And it's just coming to the point where they would even come out to listen to see if we could play or not.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
C.J. Chenier. He and the Red Hot Louisiana Band have a new album called Hot Rod on Slash Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have from the Gulf?
Terry, as you know, Anne Geralds is over there now, and she will be filing a piece on the latest Arab Peace Initiative. We'll also be talking about contributions from the members of the coalition and sharing the burden of the war in the Gulf, if there is one, and political support at home for the possibility of conflict. We're also going to talk to some American teenagers and ask them what I guess is really the bottom line question about war. What do you think there is that is worth dying for?
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John Edgar Wideman writes mostly about what African-American men are up against in this country. He writes both fiction and nonfiction. His new book is Philadelphia Fire. Critic John Leonard has a review.
On May 13, 1985, on Osage Avenue in West Philadelphia, a group of black people, members of a cult that called itself MOVE, living in the city as if in the woods, in smelly disorder, refused a court order to abandon their home. So a SWAT team shot up that home, and a police helicopter dropped a bomb on it, and 6 adults and 5 children died, and 53 houses were destroyed, and 262 people were left homeless, and a grand jury decided not to indict anybody. And this bombing is one of the things John Edgar Wideman's remarkable new book is about. But Philadelphia Fire, part novel, part memoir, part deconstruction of the text of black American manhood, is also about politics in City Hall and on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, about history and Indian ghosts with flame-colored bodies in the ruins of the city, about adults left out of Western culture and children lost to drugs and prison and rage, about failed marriages, exile, basketball, and The Tempest, a play by Earl the Pearl Shakespeare. Cudjoe is an African-American writer and teacher, a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, who ran away from his job, his marriage, and Philadelphia to a Greek island. On Mykonos, he heard about Osage Avenue. He returns, hoping to write a book and to find a child, a creature of ash and skin and wind, who escaped the fire and vanished into the city, who became Simba, a hero, magic, they say. But Cudjoe is only one of several alter egos of the novelist Wideman. Others include the mad clairvoyant of Osage Avenue, called King, and Timbo, the mayor's man, who went to Penn with Cujo, and J.B., a derelict who also went to Penn, who lives on garbage and pretends blindness, and who carries in a stolen briefcase a loaded gun. And there's also the novelist Weidman himself, who shows up in person in the second half of the book. Cujo can't write at all, he says, without splitting apart. Neither can Weidman, he admits here, apportioning his mind to these children of Caliban. Weidman also ran away into the literature of the West, into Shakespeare and Joyce, and he despairs here of his own son going mad in prison. How does it feel, the novelist asks, to be inhabited by more than oneself? Philadelphia Fire is a book of brilliant correspondences, but not of tidy closure. It can't wrap itself up, because the culture is schizophrenic. If Cujo seeks the lost Simba, Weidman mourns his lost son. If Osage Avenue burns, so will the derelict, J.B. And if there's a Greek island, there is also Shakespeare's, with Caliban, that dark thing, the first slave, the first dead Indian. Before he ran away, Cujo wanted to mount an all-black children's production of The Tempest in a city park, with Caliban as hero. As if black intellectuals, having gone to Penn instead of Osage Avenue, could take Shakespeare away from the canon, from T.S. Eliot and the Wasteland. But of course Prospero, the first imperialist with his magic books, will always be the hero. Caliban will never sleep with Miranda. And the black children of the city, those who haven't been shot, blown up, burnt, drowned, or hanged from basketball rims, run wild in war paint on the city streets at the end of Philadelphia Fire, instead of speaking Shakespeare. This is The Fire, next time.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Philadelphia Fire by John Edgar Weidman. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Roberta Shurrock, Joan Tuohy, and Sue Spolin, and research assistance from Dan Buskirk and Lisa Bocchini. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We know who killed Laura Palmer. On the next Fresh Air, we find out something about the actor who played the killer. Ray Wise starred on Twin Peaks as Leland Palmer. Also, we talk about the current violence in South Africa with journalist Stephen Mufson of The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.